Atheist Nomads, episode 357. Those damn salmon.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and here in just a tiny little bit, we'll be talking with Dan Lombardo, who you've probably heard on Ask an Atheist if you listen to that show. He does the Moment of Science segment on that show ever so often, and he deals with science education, marine science education in the Seattle area, and works with Camp Quest Northwest, and is has a degree in environmental science. And we ended up talking a lot about salmon and the Columbian Snake Rivers, and that's just because it's relevant to where both of us live, and seriously relevant to the entire northwestern U.S. and parts of southwestern Canada. Very, very critical to the ecosystem of, in particular, the Intermountain region that's not in the Great Basin. And so it was a really good discussion. It went really long, so I'm going to try to get into that as quickly as possible. I have been continuing to try to make some changes with how my workflow is to try to make things easier for me, make it less likely for errors to happen, and just to make it easier for me to do the podcast and take out some, just make my process more efficient. And so I'm playing around with some a new to me digital audio workstation, and it's making the cut process, right, cutting out dead air, easy enough with some scripting that I was able to very easily do following a guide I found, and the program's Reaper. It's made it so that I can cut out dead air a lot faster than I've been able to in the other applications that I've used. So I am going to be trying, for the first time since like episode 20, not automatically truncating all of the silence. Yeah, a big benefit this should have is increasing the natural feel of the flow of the discussion. But it's a difference. It's a change. Let me know how that comes across to you. And also playing around with some of the plugins available with Reaper to do more automated leveling and compression, more directly target based on loudness. So yeah, the compression and leveling is all getting handled automatically, and that feels a little weird to me, having set up complicated, convoluted compression staging at various points in the process to tighten up all the audio everywhere. And I think it sounds pretty good, but again, let me know what you think. It's going to be a little bit different, but not, hopefully this isn't too terribly different than usual. And if anything, hopefully it's a little bit better. And next week's interview is with Alice Ashton, and that one's already recorded, and then I'll be recording another one this weekend for later on. But I hope you enjoy the interview with Dan. Right now, I am now joined by Dan Lombardo. And Dan, Hi. If you listen to the, if you listen to Ask an Atheist, you're familiar with Dan. He's a really cool guy. I've actually met up with him in person several times at some of the trips to the Puget Sound. And yeah, you're a cool guy. It's good to finally get you onto the podcast.
Thank you. You're a cool guy too.
So. You seems like you do everything that like every little kid would want to do. Like you get to spend summers at camp. You get to do all kinds of cool sciencey stuff. At least at some points you've worked on a boat doing sciencey stuff. And
yeah, still.
Yeah. Like, dude, that's like every little kid's dream.
You know, it was certainly my dream when I was a little kid. I went through kind of a lot of different stages as a little kid of what I wanted to do with my life. But one of the constant things was I wanted to do something with marine biology. And I ended up in my early 20s, actually, when I was 20, I started working for just a tour boat company where we'd go between Seattle and Victoria, British Columbia. It was kind of a lot like being a deckhand / flight attendant.
Yeah, but in like the most beautiful spot in the world.
Oh, yeah, in the most beautiful spot in the world, yeah. And I had volunteered in the past with an organization called Sound Experience that's a nonprofit that owns a historic tall ship called the Schooner Adventurous. And, you know, learned a little bit about sailing on Puget Sound from doing that. And, of course, I grew up around the water. But after a couple summers working for Victoria Clipper, the position to be a naturalist for the whale watch tours that they provided came up. And they kind of went out on a limb, since I had no formal college education at that point, and offered me the position based just sort of on my knowledge and interests. And
wow.
And really took off with it. The unfortunate thing about it was, you know, to be good at being a whale watch naturalist, you need to be able to answer whatever questions, and you need to keep up on the newest information. And year by year, what we learned was that, you know, not only was this population of killer whales, the southern resident killer whales, southern resident orcas, not only were they in serious decline health-wise and emaciation, their population numbers, but actually whale watching was playing a role in that.
Oh, that, no.
That the constant attention from these whale watch boats.
Yep.
Was creating a significant enough sound disturbance that it was impacting their hunting efficacy. And this particular population, they only hunt salmon. And so, and salmon are scarce and getting scarcer all over the world, especially here in the Pacific Northwest. So it was sort of one of those things where I kind of had to look at it and be like, boy, I love my job, but it's hurting them. You know, these are some of these animals I know as individuals. I was there when one of them was born, you know, on scene. And,
oh, wow.
And realizing that what I was doing was causing harm was a pretty hard thing to face.
Well, once you've reached the point where you've spent enough time with them that you can actually identify which one's which.
Yeah.
You've got a definite connection.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. And you observe their different personalities and you know, watch the way that they interact with their favorite other individuals, and the way that they work as a community, the way that they interact with other pods within their community. In this community of orcas, there are three pods, three separate families.
Okay.
And the way that they interact with each other, and you know, you can tell when they get together that certain members from J pod are closer to particular members from L pod or K pod. And that when they get together, that these individuals are happy to see these specific other individuals. It's not just that the pods are getting together. It's not just a chance to mate. It's a chance to socialize, you know, and act like people.
And even just being able to identify when they're happy. That takes a lot of observation. So you got to know these orcas really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, learning that what I'd been doing for the summers of almost 10 years had been harming them was a pretty bitter pill to swallow. But that was part of what got me to quit working there and go back to school and study biology and environmental science. And then when I came out of college, I got right into fisheries research and salmon conservation.
Okay.
From there started working in environmental education and found that, I enjoy that a lot more than research. That my talents present my talents are more directed towards entertaining a crowd, and environmental education was sort of the perfect outlet for that.
Yeah, and that is when you can entertain a crowd while talking about the environment. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you have to sort of. You have to inspire people. It is not an easy fight to stay in. It's an easy thing to get started with, but when you're exposed to the losses and the devastation and the constant string of bad news that comes in the environmental fight, you know, you really have to cling to the victories hard. You really have to, you have to make the choice every day to remain determined and mm-hmm. to sort of find your well of hope. And personally, my my ability to maintain hope in the light of available evidence kind of comes from converting rage into something else. That you know, they say anger is a great motivating power.
Yeah.
And I feel like Mark Ruffalo going, well, here's my secret. I'm angry all the time.
Well, and just looking, like, when you look at Salmon alone, that is one of those things that, like, even the Republican governor of Idaho has acknowledged that climate change is a serious issue and we need to take action because of the salmon.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. When he was a little kid, he'd go to Redfish Lake outside of Stanley, and it was red from the backs of all the salmon.
Right.
And now you almost never get any salmon that make it to the lake.
Right.
And
yeah, the numbers have been in the tens.
Yeah.
Of those that actually make it that far.
And he's been able to, you know, in his life, he has observed with making those trips, being able to watch firsthand the decline of salmon. And, you know, heck, just a couple of years ago, we had massive die-offs from river water temperature getting too high with the droughts that we were having.
Right. This is something that is reoccurring every year. It was not a one-year event. It was just publicized biggest one year.
Yeah.
There are a whole lot of problems on the Columbia River and Snake River system. Not the least of which is the system of dams on those rivers. They are a huge impediment to anything trying to make its way upstream or downstream. The reservoirs behind them are warm and tend towards low oxygen, high temperature, toxic algae blooms, invasive predators, kind of you name it. And when you consider the number of dams on the system, there is a problem.
Heck, one of those dams even just stopped and buried what had been one of the top, I think it was 5 waterfalls in the world.
Salilo Falls. Yeah, yeah. That's the Dalles Dam. Yeah. And that wasn't exactly an accident. Thing about Salilo Falls, the thing about large dams in general in this country is they are an active and deliberate part of the Native American genocide. The reason that the Dalles Dam was placed there, it wasn't actually the best place to put a dam to get the largest reservoir or the most electricity out of it. The reason that it was placed there was because Salilo Falls was a gathering place for numerous tribes from around the Northwest. They would come to this place because the salmon were so plentiful. It was almost like neutral territory. You know, everybody could come there. Everybody could harvest. And so it ended up being a place where families from different tribes and different tribes in general could sort of form alliances, and there were a lot of weddings that took place after meetings there. It was a way of maintaining unity between these peoples. And so when they decided to build a large system of dams, it was very deliberate to place one there, to put this entire culturally important site underwater. The goal was to break the unity of these peoples. It wasn't just to create agriculture or irrigation or generate electricity
or shipping.
It was specifically an act of genocide. It was specifically an act of war. Yeah.
Right. Because you didn't need that one in particular for power generation. Right. By that point, there was already more than enough power generation for the entire region.
Mm-hmm.
The canal technology by that point was enough to be able to build a shipping channel around it.
Yep.
Yeah. And a diversion dam.
And looking along the Columbia and Snake Rivers, one thing you'll notice if you ever drive the length of either is there are train tracks all the way.
Uh-huh.
You don't need a system of locks. You don't need a system of barges. There was already rail by the time those dams were built. There was already another way.
Yeah. So what benefit would the barges have provided?
Excellent question.
And especially when you consider the Columbia River is one of the most difficult, like the mouth of it is one of the worst and most difficult to navigate places on the oceans at all.
Right. Yeah, it's a difficult, tumultuous place. It's prone to extremely high winds, high waves that come with it. It's an ecologically strange place. The bottom topography is constantly changing. You know, that where there was a sandbar yesterday, there might not be a sandbar tomorrow, and it might be, you know, a half a mile away. Amazing place if you're a windsurfer, but if you're trying to carry a large craft with deep drafts through the area, it's less than ideal.
Especially if it's full of grain.
Right, right. one of the big reasons that the system of dams have been built where they are, as I mentioned, to flood people out of places that they didn't want, and very specific peoples. Another reason is that when you build these giant reservoirs, you are essentially banking power.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having, you know, heaps of coal or piles of fuel or nuclear materials in storage, you have a giant tank of water, and you can turn the cash flow on and off almost literally by opening a valve.
Yep.
But that's what they're really for. They don't actually conserve water. Most reservoirs, even in temperate climates like this one, tend to lose more water to evaporation mm-hmm. than the river would throughout the same course. So there's an argument that they're a waste of our limited freshwater resources. They tend to heat up the water. They tend to cause toxic algae blooms. There's a lot of concern about eutrophication. And, you know, that's stuff that doesn't just affect fish. That's stuff that affects everything downstream.
Right.
It even affects the local climate. If you're around a big warm reservoir, you're going to have a hotter, sultrier climate than you would if you had a fast moving river with a riparian zone.
And like, you look at the algae blooms, those dams have enabled a lot more agriculture in the mm-hmm. desert. That agriculture in the desert requires a lot of fertilizer.
That it does.
The runoff provides a lot of nitrogen for the river with nice, warm, slow, stagnant water.
Exactly.
Like, it's the perfect recipe for algae.
Right. And you kind of get this, you sort of get this positive feedback loop about it, which is, you know, the warmer and the more toxic the water gets, the more opaque the water becomes. And the more opaque it becomes, the more sunlight it absorbs, and the warmer it gets, and the more toxic it gets, because the algae are thriving in that situation. And eventually you get to the point where the water is so eutrophic, you have this massive die-off of the algae. Even the algae can't survive.
Yeah.
So the algae dies, goes to the bottom, decomposes, and as it's decomposing, the bacteria are having a giant party.
Mm-hmm.
You end up releasing giant amounts of methane and CO2 into the atmosphere. It's believed right now that large dam reservoirs are between the number 4 and number 5 producers of methane on planet Earth.
Holy shit.
Yeah, most people don't know that at all.
Because, and again, it's because methane, nitrogen's a big part of that one too, right? So it's the nitrogen coming in from...
Nitrogen is not in methane.
Oh, no, it's not. Okay. But it is feeding the algae, which are producing...
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
All those nitrates, and ammonia, and phosphates that are used in land-based synthetic fertilizers. Yeah. And there's kind of an irony over the whole thing, is that, you know, colonizers come out west and decide, we're going to turn this area into Western Europe, and we're going to grow Western mm-hmm. Europe crops. And end up producing a lot less food, a lot less efficiently, with a much higher environmental impact than was done by indigenous peoples here, and is still done by indigenous peoples here, in the places where they can. Native plants are going to thrive better.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to need less water. They're going to need less resources, less intervention, because this is the climate that they evolved to. So I think one of the things that we have to think about when we're talking about a sustainable future in agriculture is dropping the idea that we need to have, you know, lettuce and carrots and radishes and beets and all these, you know, Western mm-hmm. European crops be our staples. What we should probably be doing is eating regionally. And that even goes to when we talk about meats. A huge amount of North America has been converted to grazing lands for cattle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cattle don't really come from this part of the world. Cattle belong in places around the Mediterranean. Yeah, in this climate. And so the foods here, some of the some of the natural growing plants here are going to be poisonous to them, and they're not going to be able to metabolize them as well as the native species.
Yeah.
And sort of the real irony of it is we wiped out the bison, bring in the railroads, and also to disenfranchise native people. And then we replaced our native grazers with cattle that graze much less efficiently and take huge amounts of land to produce less and less meat and huge amounts of water to produce less and less meat. Where if we would just sort of make the switch and go, actually, bison is just as good as beef. Instead of having grazing lands full of cows, let's have grazing lands full of bison, like they were, 500 years ago.
Yeah. Well, and like I spent 6 weeks in Jordan back in 2007, and I had beef there twice out of 6 weeks. Mostly ate goat and chicken. The reason is nobody raises beef in Jordan. It would be stupid in the desert to raise a commercially viable amount of cattle. I live in Idaho now, where you have a desert with a lot of beef production.
Yeah. And then massive areas growing corn to feed that beef.
Yep.
Where alternatively, you can grow perfectly nutritious native plants, things like camas, things like serviceberry, that are nutritionally superior and require less intervention, require less resources. And on the same lands where you're growing these native plants, you can also have grazing bison.
Yeah. And less fire as a result, because the native plants do a lot better than cheatgrass.
Right. And grazers like bison keep the brush level down, so the wildfires don't get quite as out of hand as they do on unmanaged land.
You know,
there's this sort of myth that colonizers brought agriculture, and it's just not true. Mm-hmm. What we brought is a different set of crops.
Yeah. Well, and my wife's made a concerted effort with our yard, knowing that growing a lawn in a desert environment is ridiculous. We still do have lawns, but we got local varieties of drought tolerant grasses. It's a local blend from a local company that you don't have to water it as much as Kentucky bluegrass. And by not as much, I mean like in the height of summer, you water it for 20 minutes, three times a week, and you're good, as opposed to maybe every single day when it's 110 degrees out.
Right.
And with the flowers, she's made a concerted effort to plant native flowers, or at least native to the region, and drought tolerant flowers. And again, they don't need as much water. If we were to try to grow stuff native to Britain and Europe in Idaho.
You're going to have to try to simulate that, moist and temperate climate. And it's just not, it's just not viable.
When it's 8% relative humidity and 115 degrees, that just doesn't work. So all of this has a negative impact on the fish, of course.
Of course, yeah. And it's not just salmon that use that river system. A lot of things that don't really get considered are fish that are not well adapted to go up a salmon ladder. And boy, that's a whole other can of worms, because salmon themselves are not well adapted to go up a salmon ladder.
Right.
It is extremely challenging for a salmon to make their way up the ladder past a 700-foot tall dam. That's like the caloric equivalent of a human being climbing Mount Everest on their first try.
Yeah.
About 10% of the salmon that try to go up these salmon ladders at mega dams end up dying of exhaustion on their first attempt. Mm. And almost none of them make it to the top on their first attempt.
Oh, wow.
In turn, salmon ladders become great places for California sea lions. There's this sort of idea between Washington and Oregon along the Columbia River system that, the way we can save the salmon population is by killing off the sea lions. And it's really treating the symptom. Sea lions aren't stupid. And historically, sea lions don't travel very far upriver. There's no reason to. They're in a murky environment. It's going against them. Their skin becomes hypotonic, and their skin gets irritated and leads to bacterial and fungal infections when they're spending that much time in fresh water. So why would a sea lion swim, 100 miles up the Columbia River? Well, because they figured out what a salmon ladder is. It is very hard to hunt salmon in a river that's a mile wide and silty. All the noise from the river interferes with their hunting by passive hearing. They can't see very far. Their big, powerful eyes are really not helping them in that environment. But you build a dam across this river and then build an exhausting obstacle for the salmon to get past, to salmon ladder to get up that dam. And then you bottleneck all the salmon into an area that's 30 to 100 feet wide. And you basically have a conveyor belt of exhausted or dying salmon washing down to the bottom, too tired and too disoriented to avoid predation. Seals and sea lions are notably intelligent animals. They figured this out. So, you know, you could go down there and you can start killing off the seals and sea lions, and that'll probably work for a little while. But the thing is, they're going to keep coming back, because the problem isn't the seals. It's not that these marine mammals are overpopulated. It's that the dam is there and the salmon are underpopulated. And the dam being there is a major factor to the salmon being underpopulated. So that's an issue with salmon and salmon ladders. And that's not even addressing the smolts, the young ones that are trying to come downstream. That's just the adults going upstream. But these river systems also supported huge populations of Pacific lamprey, which were just as important a food source for native peoples as the salmon. They also produced, these rivers also supported white sturgeon and green sturgeon. And enormous sturgeon, white sturgeon, can grow to be over 15 feet long, way over 1,000 pounds. I mean, they're roughly the size of a white shark when they're fully grown. Yeah. They cannot go up a salmon ladder. The spaces between jumps are just not big enough to fit their body. And so we end up with these sturgeon populations crashing.
We have a few sturgeon that actually live within the city limits of Boise, on the Boise River, and hang out around some of the parks where they're protected. And there's a park where you can walk over a little side channel from the river and often look down and see this, you know, 10-foot-long sturgeon.
Right. And but an animal like that isn't going to be able to go up a salmon ladder or make it downstream either. So they become a landlocked population. Then there's a ramification from that. Out on the coast, we have oyster farms. And oyster farms are very, very ecologically sound. It is one of the few kinds of aquaculture that has a net positive environmental impact. It is better to have an oyster farm there than to not have it.
Oh, wow.
They create habitat. They sequester carbon. They generate meat. They do all kinds of great stuff. They even filter the water and prevent eutrophication events. Oysters are a pretty cool animal. But one of the big problems at oyster farms is two kinds of shrimp called mud shrimp or sand shrimp, respectively. And they like to burrow in the sand and sort of create their little colonies, a lot like an ant farm. And they'll undermine the oyster bed to the point where the oysters sink in and get trapped under silt and suffocate. They're a huge pest for an oyster farm. So when the tide goes very far out, a lot of oyster farms will fly over in sort of a crop duster and spray a chemical called imidacloprid, which paralyzes any kind of arthropod. So any crab, any shrimp, any isopod, even things like, you know, ants and spiders can get paralyzed by this thing. But it's primarily used to control mud shrimp and ghost shrimp around and underneath oyster farms. So we have to use this pesticide that damages basically everything in the area. Even the little copepods that live in the plankton get paralyzed and killed by this stuff. Well, there was a natural pest control for oyster beds, and it was those sturgeon. It was the white sturgeon and green sturgeon. They are what controls the population of mud shrimp and ghost shrimp. So we put in this dam, we build the salmon ladder, we handicap the sturgeon population, and lo and behold, we handicap the oyster population too. And when we handicap the oyster population, we create lower oxygen water that's more prone to eutrophication, even out in the ocean. We create more acidic conditions by doing this thing.
Oh, wow.
Then we can talk about eulachon. Eulachon are a little fish. They're a type of a smelt. They're not much longer than your hand when they're fully grown. They were also called candlefish. That's an old name for them, because they're so greasy that you can hang them up to dry. And once they're dried, you light their tail and carry them around in a shell, and that's basically your flashlight. They will burn for hours.
Oh,
like
wow.
a candle.
Huh. That's the grease
that's in a Ulacan, it also doesn't go rancid. It takes years to go rancid when it's properly dried. And so there was an entire trade system known as the grease trails throughout North America, where Ulacan grease from the Northwest was traded as food, as lubricant, as something used to treat leather, as something used to treat sinew, as something used to waterproof wood, traded by indigenous peoples for a million purposes, including just calories, all around North America. But these small fish, these Ulacan, are not strong enough to swim up something like a salmon ladder. And they used to make their way all the way up to Montana, just going up the system of rivers.
Yeah.
So when we cut them off, so we've got the salmon, we've got the lamprey, mm-hmm. we've got the sturgeon, the Ulacan, all cut off. And there is another big service that all of these creatures provide that is one that's often overlooked. And that is that they are feeding predators along the way, as adults, as young, as eggs. Everything that can eat them eats them.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with salmon that die after spawning, what they're really doing is bringing nutrients from the ocean and leaving it on the land in their decaying carcasses.
Yeah.
So when we look at like the state of Washington out on the West Coast, we have some of the world's fastest growing forests. Our temperate rainforests sequester more carbon per hectare than even the Amazon rainforest. And they do it faster, and they do it through the darkest, coldest months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Something that our coniferous forests are adapted to do. So when we're looking at the deciduous forests of the tropics that are sequestering carbon successfully in the summertime, and then we've got our temperate forests sequestering it in the wintertime, we're doing a really good thing. We're hitting this problem from both angles.
Yeah.
Well, the reason that in Western Washington, the reason our forests can grow so incredibly fast is salmon. For 6.5 million years, the salmon have been coming up the rivers, spawning and dying, and leaving nitrates, ammonia, phosphates, potassium, all that stuff that they got out in the ocean, they leave it there in the soil. At the same time, when we talk about unsustainable desert agriculture, well, in eastern Washington, as you know, it's a desert. It's technically what's called a scab land, which means all of it at one point was molten lava that cooled down and became rock. And normally in a scab land, you can grow stuff like sage. Maybe you can grow stuff like yucca.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be able to grow all kinds of, you know, fancy Western crops. Well, in our scab land, with enough water, we can grow grapes that rival the finest regions of Europe. Mm-hmm.
And with enough sun that you can grow any grape you want whenever you want.
Absolutely. And in Eastern Washington, we grow most of the country's apples. We grow most of the entire region's cherries. We can grow all these crops there because for 6.5 million years, salmon have been swimming up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, spawning and dying and leaving those nutrients from the ocean on the land, in the soil, in a place where normally it would be pretty nutritionally dead, where there isn't going to be any sort of fertilizer, where there aren't going to be nitrates and ammonia and phosphates and potassium. But the salmon did this, and they did it for us for free. It was just this conveyor belt of nutrients from the ocean to the land. So when we put off these systems of dams that block them from doing this, when we harm the ocean populations through overfishing, when we destroy the nearshore habitat and the estuaries from development, we're clogging our own arteries. We are stealing from ourselves. One of the really cool things about the population of salmon is that they bounce back from natural disasters amazingly fast. They've evolved in a part of the world that is prone to earthquakes, landslides, volcanic eruptions, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Things that can obliterate any particular run, obliterate any particular river practically overnight. And yet, salmon have adapted to do this. And they can bounce back from any kind of pressure just amazingly fast.
Well, and
just from an economic standpoint, it's absolutely insane to damage these populations. The really big sort of take home from it, when I look at the future of humans, when I look at feeding as many mouths as we can, as high a quality food as we can, if you have healthy populations of salmon and you have healthy freshwater and estuarine and marine habitats for them, if they have enough food, if they have clean, cold, clear water where they can thrive, you can harvest 50% of the entire global population every single year. For human consumption alone, and they will continue to bounce back.
50%
of the entire global population every year, and they will continue to bounce back. And that gives you an idea of just how much we have damaged that their populations and their habitat by the state that they're in now, where our salmon runs throughout the Pacific Northwest. Some of them are fully extinct. Most are between 1 and 10% of their historical size.
Yeah. Well, and Redfish Lake, going back to that example, it has the name because it used to be full of salmon every fall.
Great, like, red sockeye salmon.
The entire lake would be red as far as... The entire thing would be red, full of salmon.
Yeah.
And now, on a good year, 10 might get there. On a bad year, none get there.
Yep.
And that's way up in central Idaho. That would be bringing in a ridiculous amount of nutrients from the ocean to 600 miles inland.
Yeah.
500 miles inland, at least.
I think if you follow the river route from the mouth of the Columbia up to Redfish Lake, we're looking at just over 900 miles.
Yeah. It's a long distance.
It's 900 miles. And look at your average sockeye salmon. They are not big. They're the second smallest of the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
A big sockeye salmon is, 7-8 pounds. That's a pretty good size one. So you're looking at this relatively small fish, this 7-8 pound fish that gets into freshwater. It stops eating, completely stops eating. They do not eat in freshwater. It's one of the things that sort of keeps them from eating their own young migrating downstream. So they start swimming up this river, and they're going to be going up these giant salmon ladders, one after another. I think between Redfish Lake and the Columbia, I could be wrong on this, but it's at least 9, might be 11 dams. But they're doing this over and over and over, losing 10% every time they have to go up the salmon ladder. They're losing 10% of those that are making their way up.
So actually being technically decimated at every single one.
Decimated at every dam, yes. And so you've got them making their way up river, no food. Only the energy that they got out in the ocean. And out in the ocean, sockeye are eating a lot of krill. And even krill, some of the most numerous organisms on the planet, are suffering under more acidic ocean conditions. Mm-hmm. They have a harder time growing their exoskeleton. The more CO2 that's in the water, the less available calcium becomes. And that's a whole other chemistry lesson. But anyhow, so these fish are, they're making their way up the freshwater. They don't eat. They manage to get past, between 9 and 11 dams. And the entire way, they're going to go up more than 6,000 feet of elevation. They are going higher than Stevens or Snoqualmie Pass. I mean, they're going almost as high as Mount Olympus up in the Olympic mountain range, jump by jump, waterfall by waterfall, salmon ladder by salmon ladder, climbing, climbing, climbing. This trip might take them 3 months from the time that they first taste fresh water.
Yeah.
No food. So 3 months of mountain climbing, of salmon ladders, of starvation. It's a miracle that even a handful of them can make it to that lake under these conditions.
Yeah.
And that's not even accounting for the warm water, the low oxygen, the toxic algae blooms, the invasive predators, all of that stuff. Even human fishermen along the shore, and still a handful of them make it.
Yeah.
If we could give them a clear shot, we wouldn't be seeing, 10, 20 salmon making it. We'd be seeing hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And it's something that we can do. It is something that is absolutely doable.
Back in his heyday, I think it was literally millions were going to Redfish Lake specifically.
Like, that wouldn't surprise me.
The name of the river, that river is the Salmon River.
Yeah.
If you've got enough to fill an entire lake going through it, it would have been like the whole river would have turned red.
Yeah.
During the run.
When I was about 12 years old, I was lucky enough to get up to Alaska and fish on the Kenai River during the sockeye run. And it was amazing. The sockeye were already in their spawning colorations, which means they're not going to taste so great at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They've sort of metabolized all the omega-3s out of their body and turned it into those bright red sides where it used to be the compound that makes their meat so delicious. So we're not trying to catch the sockeye. We're trying to catch coho that are just starving their run. To find a place on the river where I could cast out to try to catch the few coho in among these millions of sockeye, I literally had to scoot my feet along the rocks and push fish out of the way just to find a place to stand.
Oh, wow.
And at one point, I accidentally took a dive in the river because while I was feeling around for the next boulder, it turned out to be a rather large sockeye and not, in fact, a rock. So when I put my weight on it, the fish went out from underneath and I got swept 100 yards down a very cold, fast-moving Alaskan river. But that's what it should look like on every river in the Northwest. That's what it did look like. And if we do things right, that's what it can look like again. We can get this back.
And looking at the snake, prior to the dams, they can make it as far as Shoshone Falls. And that still leaves half of Idaho inaccessible to salmon. And the the headwaters in Montana and Wyoming also inaccessible. So they moved it to Oxbow Dam as no fish ladder. Salmon just can't go past that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a big deal. It's only 150 miles down the river. What's the big deal there? The Boise River, Owyhee River, Malheur River. We're talking about river basins that cover all of southeastern Idaho or southwestern Idaho and all of southeastern Oregon that's not in the Great Basin.
Right.
The salmon population was just completely eliminated.
Yep.
100% gone.
Yeah. 100% gone. Yeah, it is disturbing. And I don't want to vilify, you know, the entire hydropower industry. That's, you know, companies are made out of people, and most people are pretty good people. It's not like there are some, you know, mustache twirling villains out there trying to figure out how they're going to destroy the world. A lot of the reason that we do things this way is because this is what we've done for the past 100 years.
Yeah.
This is what we've done from the time that Woody Guthrie used to write songs about it, you know?
And one angle on the Columbia dams and snake to a lesser extent, that was post-World War II reclamation projects to try to figure out how to get jobs for veterans so they wouldn't rebel against the government if the economy didn't actually recover after the war.
Right, right. And so when I look at, you know, the way that they're operated and run now, between East and Western Washington, there is a huge political divide. And I think a huge chunk of why we haven't removed a lot of these dams, especially the outdated ones that we know they're reaching their topping over points, that we know they're becoming a threat to the towns around them and downstream of them. A lot of the reason that we don't remove them is that political divide, because there is an environmental benefit to doing it. And if we do it, the hippies win. When we look at the economics of the situation, large dams are ridiculously expensive to maintain and to inspect. And every one of them has a lifespan. At this point, the Army Corps of Engineers that is operating the infamous four lower Snake River dams, the technology does not yet exist to dredge sediment out from behind those dams and move it downstream as fast as it builds up, which means every day there is more and more liquefied earth behind these dams. That is heavy material that the dams were not really designed to hold back.
And those are old dams now.
Right. And if that isn't dealt with, then a breach is imminent. That's just a fact of the matter. This is why the dams have spillways and that. But even then, the spillway wasn't designed to deal with the amount of sediment that's constantly building up.
And we keep on getting back and forth between drought and flood condition.
Right. Which means there's no stability to the temperature of the river downstream.
Yep. Because
that's another issue.
We saw that here with several drought years and then 150% of average snowpack. I think this was 3 years ago. And the Army Corps of Engineers, who supervise the Lucky Peak Dam just above Boise, was having to watch the amount of water flowing into that dam. And that's just off of the Boise River. It's not a major river known by anybody outside of the region. That dam had reached capacity early in spring runoff, and they were having to open up the spillways more and more and more because they knew if they didn't start flooding neighborhoods, downtown Boise would be gone.
Right. Yeah, this is an issue. The reason that we have these large reservoirs is so that we can harvest their kinetic energy in bursts to generate electricity. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Except that when you realize, if you're not continuously harvesting it, you're not continuously letting it flow, when the sediment is piling up behind it, when our climate is becoming less and less predictable, that kinetic energy is a bomb.
Yeah.
It is a giant bomb with the capacity to end tens or hundreds of thousands of lives downstream. And just on top of that, on top of the very real risk of a dam failing, of a dam breaching, they are a giant target for a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about things like national security in the modern world, you know, the kinds of attacks that we're receiving are not things like directed nuclear weapons. We're receiving things that come as a surprise that we didn't expect, where somebody decides that, hey, you know what, an aluminum tube full of jet fuel is actually a very surprisingly good way to destroy a large building. I cannot imagine that there is anyone out there that wishes to do harm to our nation or its people that doesn't see the giant amount of kinetic energy behind these large dams, behind these aging, poorly maintained dams.
Oh, and if you hit it when they're full, you can
the
hit...
The pressure does the work for you.
You can hit one upstream and take out all of them.
Chain reaction, yeah.
And say bye-bye to Portland.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is something that we have to think about when we talk about it. It's not just the economics. It's not just a bunch of fucking fish, as people like to say on the east side. It's a threat. It is a national security threat. It is a climate change threat. It's a threat to our ocean fisheries. It's a threat to our freshwater fisheries. It's a threat to our recreation. It's a threat to the stability of our drinking water. It's a threat to the cleanliness of our drinking water. It's a threat to our agricultural technologies. It's time to walk away from this experiment. You know, hydroelectrics was our first real try at green electricity. And I think it's about time that we say, all right, you know, we've learned that there are good ways to do it. We've learned there are bad ways to do it. And it's time to say that we've grown up, that we've moved on. And if we still want to do hydroelectrics, there are great ways of doing it. There are run-of-river projects, where instead of having a large dam, you exploit more of the length of the river and end up causing less impact.
Yeah. And weird.
There's even waterfall projects like Snoqualmie Falls or Niagara Falls, where you take a naturally impassable thing and basically just drill a diagonal tunnel and put a turbine at the bottom.
But like, there's some of the power generating dams in Idaho are the falls for Idaho Falls is because it didn't have any falls, so they built some.
Right.
They put a weir across the river, a small dam. They're generating a little bit of power off of it. It doesn't impact the flow of the river, but it provides just enough back pressure to be able to run a turbine.
Right. They're big enough to create that back pressure and small enough that fish can jump them, that sediment can flow over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you need to put in a salmon ladder, they're going up 15, 20 feet, which is something a fish can do pretty easily.
And if the water level rises during spring runoff, it just flows over the top.
Right. Just flows over the top. Yeah. And it cannot hold back enough water to destroy a medium-sized city.
Okay. So what would you suggest for the Northwest to replace the dams for power without going to coal?
I think probably the best proposals that I've seen are wind that goes along the river corridor. Because there's a kind of interesting thing about that. People always criticize wind and say, oh, well, the wind is so inconsistent. And I hear that argument from people who don't live in areas that are windy. Because where they are from, the wind is inconsistent. Like, here in Tacoma, yes, the wind is incredibly inconsistent. Mm-hmm. This isn't a great place for large-scale wind power. Anywhere that there is enough grade, that there is enough of an incline that it's worth putting a dam to develop, to generate hydroelectricity, there is also an equal grade to the shoreline of that river.
Mm-hmm.
Cooling air follows the path of least resistance, just like water does. So when you've got mountains nearby, you end up with these channels that become the path for the water, that become the rivers and streams. Well, they're also the path for the cool air at night and the warm air in the morning. And since wind turbines are a lot less disruptive to an ecosystem, especially once they're constructed. Once they're constructed, there's very low impact from them being there. You can line miles and miles of a river system with wind turbines, and you can still get that that constant and reliable wind, as long as the earth spins, as long as the sun shines, mm-hmm. as long as the steepness persists, you're going to have reliable power.
Okay.
So you can actually harvest more power more cleanly by installing turbines alongside a river system than by installing dams.
So a combination of that and non-massive dam hydroelectric, modern hydroelectric, projects. We could call it.
Modern hydroelectric is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah. How feasible would it be to replace the power generation of the Lower Columbia?
Very feasible and can probably be done very quickly.
Hmm.
And one of the cool things about the Columbia's system of dams is that it is a lock system meant to transport barges,
mm-hmm.
which means, you know, you don't have to go through the giant melodramatic situation of blowing a dam like they did on the Condit Dam or on the down on the White Salmon River, or even on the Elwha River, where they destroyed the lower Elwha and the Glynis Canyon Dam in relatively dramatic, although, you know, over the course of a few years, operations. Because we have those lock systems in place, mm-hmm. all you have to do is open the doors and let the rivers flow. You don't have to go through the billions and billions of dollars it would take to destroy these massive concrete objects. All you got to do is open the door.
So open the locks and call it done?
Basically, yeah. Until the river gets low enough, and then if you still want to remove the concrete, then you can.
Huh.
It's as simple as that.
Wow.
There's a lot to moderating the water flow, and you know, there's probably going to be times where you're going to have to restrict it to protect cities like, say, Portland.
Mm-hmm. But you don't need as many dams for flood control.
Right. And many of the dams along the Columbia and Snake River aren't actually effective for flood control.
That's not what they're made for.
It's not what they were built to do. Yeah. So the solutions are relatively simple. The biggest issues that we have to think of ecologically from doing so are a temporary massive increase in sediment load in the water. But we look at what happened on the Elwha Dam with over a year of heavy sedimentation, and the whole system bounced back so fast. Turns out salmon evolved in a place that has landslides. Heavy mm-hmm. sedimentation doesn't stop them.
and who travel through an area with active volcanoes.
Right. Yeah, this kind of, you know, large scale sudden increase is something that they're actually pretty well adapted to recover.
And glacial floods and
uh-huh. Yeah, glacial dams bursting. This uh-huh. is something that they've evolved with for millions of years. I mean, that's something they're resilient. But hot water, slow flowing water, toxic water, it's just not what they're built for. So when we look at things like switching to wind power, which is currently the fastest and cheapest method of generating electricity. It is now cheaper to install new wind turbines than to operate existing coal turbines. That's how much the technology has evolved.
Oh, wow.
So when we look at harnessing the wind from that river system, and I should say a tiny, tiny fraction of a percentage of the available wind in that river system, again, ask any windsurfer that spent mm-hmm. some time in Hood River.
Or anybody who's driven down I-84.
Right. It is a giant amount of kinetic energy that we can be using and should be using to power our technology. And that's not even to say getting offshore.
Craziest wind I've experienced on I-84, because I went to college in Walla Walla.
Uh-huh.
It was in the wintertime, and I was driving, I think, to Portland, meet up with family. And it was a cloudy day. There was white caps across the entire river. And I started noticing the waves were getting kicked up enough to blow over onto the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And one hit my windshield. I was driving down the freeway. The water was 25 feet away. And water hit my windshield from the Columbia River.
Wow.
That was some amazing kinetic energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that was probably a gallon of water that it transported 25 feet.
Yeah,
that's insane.
There is tremendous power behind the wind in that corridor. And even just harnessing the wind along that corridor could quite easily replace every one of those dams alongside that exist on that river system. We have rail for transporting things alongside mm-hmm. that same river system, and rail is very efficient.
And we could add more track if we need to.
Yeah. And barges are very efficient when you're going downstream. But once you're going upstream, they become an absolute nightmare of fuel economy. So that's a thing that we can consider when we look at the carbon impact of running running trains up and down rails. Well, it's still going to be more efficient, you know, per ton of grain or whatever else we're transporting, than having to take empty barges back upstream via tug. Now we can look at the offshore possibilities too. The Columbia River mouth would be a very difficult place to try to put offshore turbines, but you know, get 20, 30, 50 miles from there, and you've got ideal conditions where there's sort of constant medium speed winds coming off of this confluent weather system. Well, this is a great place to put in those giant offshore turbines that can generate huge amounts of electricity from just one set of blades. When you install those things, there is a very high but temporary ecological impact. They are a major disturbance when you're putting one in. But once they're done, they create kind of an island of biodiversity. All that structure in a place that was previously open water means there's going to be more encrusting organisms. There's going to be more anemones. There's going to be more mussels. There's going to be more sponges and things like that. And what you end up sort of creating is like a temperate reef where all of this biodiversity, all this kelp and stuff that's growing in waters that were otherwise shallow, you know, a few years before, increases the populations of plankton, increases the populations of small fish, increases the populations of large fish. You can go out there and look up study after study after study, and we certainly did in our fisheries research, where you're finding that where these offshore wind farms are placed, we'll give them a year later, and your commercial and recreational fishing successes go off the charts for the region. Unprecedented amounts of fish being caught because you've created the structure. So this is one of those ways that we can actually have our cake and eat it too. We can generate that power. We can have these turbines out there, and we can get a higher fish population as a result.
Holy crap.
And people will talk about, well, you know, do we really have the technology to put these big pillars out at the ocean large scale? And so, absolutely. We already have a fleet that belongs to the petroleum industry that is specifically built, customized to put storm resilient oil rigs out in the middle of deep water. This is already a thing that we do. The only difference is instead of putting a drill on it, we put a turbine on it.
Huh. And then you could just change that from being the petroleum fleet to the energy fleet.
Right. And there's no reason that even the massive conglomerates, that the Shells and Exxons, couldn't simply say, okay, we do wind now.
Yeah.
They have the money. They could probably buy up every wind company on Earth and just say, okay, we use our fleet to place wind turbines now. We can do this. We have the technology. We just have to have the will. And that is the difficult part. Change is scary. And changing an entire industry from being petrochemical to being green energy is scary. It's scary for the people who work for them. It's scary for the stockholders that invest in them. But if we're going to make it to a sustainable future for our species and for other species, we have to swallow that fear. We have to take this jump.
Yeah. Huh. And man, like, even if you just look at some of, like, because environmentally it seems like, at least where I'm at, you see some of the predicted hell already happening with in the 10 years I've lived in Boise, it's gone from a handful of days over 100 to 3 or 4 weeks every day is over 100. The last year I lived in the Puget Sound was the record 100 degree day.
Yeah.
That's happened several more times since then.
Right. It's not a record. It's not even a freak occurrence. When I was growing up here in Western Washington, I used to boast, and even into my mid to late 20s, you know, when people would say, oh, it's so beautiful here in the summer, and say, yeah, but don't move out here. It's gray and rainy for the other 9 months of the year. And it used to be. Now, boy, it's a toss-up. Our weather patterns, our climate patterns here have changed dramatically in just the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's a real slap in the face to see it. You know, and I grew up watching PSAs and Captain Planet saying, you know, this pollution and climate change, you know, it's we got to do something fast or it's going to happen. And well, now it's happening. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. It is happening.
Yeah.
And we are past the time to act. We have the tech. We have the ability. We just have to have the courage.
Yeah.
Well, and I kind of like to look at it as a Legend of Zelda thing. You know, we have the Triforce of Wisdom. We have the Triforce of Power. We just have to get the fucking Triforce of Courage to get ourselves to do this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and like where I live with the fires, the increased temperatures are causing, you know, increased temperatures are great for fires. They burn better.
Mm-hmm.
It's causing beetles to move up mountains and kill trees that can't handle them, which make them more susceptible. The salmon that we were talking about, less nutrients getting up there to keep the trees healthy, the overgrazing from cattle and seeding cheat grasses and to feed the cattle, plus cattle bringing in cheat grasses, and it's all tied in together.
It's all tied in together. And one of the things that we haven't even touched on yet is the human impact, not just from stuff like dams bursting or you know, any sort of like cataclysmic loss of life. We need to look at things like cancer rate. When we talk about what's going on with these wildfires, the amount of carcinogenic particulates that are in the air, I mean, most people don't really know this, but even campfire smoke is more carcinogenic than cigarettes. You shouldn't really be hanging around the campfire breathing this. It's not great for you.
Yeah.
I don't take my own advice on that. I personally really like the smell of campfire smoke, you know, but you know, it's a risk for the case of pleasure.
But if you're talking real health risk, a campfire doesn't do anything, just like a cigarette doesn't do anything.
Right.
It's all constant. Day, every day. Yeah, that's when you get the big problems.
And what are we seeing across the warmer parts of this region? You know, every summer now, we're seeing 8, 9, 12, 16 weeks of skies so thick with wildfire smoke that they never turn blue. They're yellow skies. I know you've seen it there. I've seen it driving all the way down to Monterey Bay, California.
We had one
that's
summer.
That's not good for a person. That is not good for a person to be exposed to every year.
We had one summer a few years back where the entire months of August and September, you couldn't see the sun.
Yeah.
It wasn't cloudy. It was just smoky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way the Rockies work and where Boise is, it kind of ends up feeling like if there's fires anywhere between Central California and British Columbia, we get the smoke here.
It's kind of the same across this region too. I mean, despite but our,
it just
our,
goes everywhere.
Yeah. 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 This is stuff that we need to deal with, and we need to deal with it imminently. There's a lot that we can do. We can put pressure on large companies. We can say, you know, I won't buy your product if you do this, but if you will do this different thing, then I'll support you 100%. That's something that I talk about a lot when I'm giving environmental lessons is, it's not exactly forgiveness, but it's being willing to change. There is a company, they have a policy that I don't like, that I think is destructive to human life or whatever, so I'm going to boycott their company. And then they make a change. And they make a change because they want profits, because they've lost customers. And people say, no, fuck you, I'm still not going to buy your product because of this thing you did. Well, now they haven't learned anything. Right. Now the company has learned that they don't get anybody back by doing the right thing. We have to teach them if that's the case. If a company decides to do the right thing, within the system that we have right now, within sort of a capitalist system, we have to use that money as our weapon. We have to be willing to say, okay, you stopped doing the thing that I wanted you to stop doing. Now I'm going to buy your fucking cheeseburger or whatever again.
Yeah.
To show them that, yes, there is a reward for doing the right thing, that this is a path worth following. And then when the people say what they want, you should do it, because if you don't, you lose business. But if you do, you gain business.
Yeah.
We have to manipulate the model from within.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to step outside of it and live in a post-scarcity economy like Star Trek. That's a great dream. But if we wait for that, we're letting perfect be the enemy of good.
Mm-hmm. And we're a long ways from having the perfect be reasonable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, we are...
overtime.
We've been recording for a while. And what's your... We've talked about environmental stuff and your work with that.
Yeah.
Which is tangentially related to the podcast. Let's get a little bit more direct.
Sure.
Okay, so you've been a frequent panelist on Ask an Atheist. You're
yeah, that's right.
Active in the
co-host, featured science communicator, yeah. All that.
Yeah. You work with Camp Quest. You're yep. pretty active in the atheist community there in the Puget Sound region. Have you always been an atheist?
You know, that's sort of a weird question. I was raised sort of quasi-religious. My mom wanted me and my brother to go to church. She was raised very religious, and so was my dad. My dad wasn't as big a fan of going to church for his own very good reasons. But my mom was into it and, you know, thought that it would be an enriching experience for us. And so she took us to a bunch of different churches, and it just kind of never stuck.
Hmm.
And then when I started going to YMCA summer camps, you know, that was back in the day when YMCA was, you know, Christian with a capital C. And we had our Bible studies and that kind of stuff. And yeah, for me, it was the least enjoyable part of camp. But then I started going to a summer camp that my friend was going to. I wanted to hang out with my friend. And so I went to this camp that was a very evangelical camp, and they were really heavy on the born again and the Jesus stuff. And the come to Jesus conversion, sinner's prayer kind of things was something that was heavily pushed at every campfire. And I may have sort of developed a stronger twinge of religion at that point, but there was something to it that, it always sort of felt like the imagination games that we played at recess as a kid, you know, when you pretend mm-hmm. to be a Ninja Turtle or whatever. It never really felt really real. And I kind of saw it as a personal flaw. Like, you know, how come everybody else believes and I just don't believe? You know, I'm pretending here and doing it by the numbers and wanting to believe so bad and trying to believe so bad. So I don't really know when people ask, you know, were you religious? Well, I certainly tried to be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever believed it. And after a few years of that, I kind of fell back out of it and sort of went my own way philosophically. And then I wanted to date this girl. Her family were super evangelical, and so was she. And so I went to her church and converted and and managed to stay evangelical Christian for about 3 years. Three, almost 4 years.
How old were you at that point?
I was about 17.
Okay.
So, you know, I went to the church and, you know, did all the stuff that I was supposed to do and sang the Christian rock songs in our worship and all that. And it was sort of the same scenario. You know, I felt like I was trying really hard to believe. I never really felt that I believed. You know, the way that it seemed that other people did. It always still felt like this thing that was kind of unknowable and imaginary. And there were a lot of things about the church pastor that I disagreed with. He was very, very anti-gay, very anti-Mormon, very anti-Asian, which was weird because we had a lot of Asian congregants. It was very strange.
Huh.
A good portion of the average sermon or youth group meetup was spent trashing other religions. And, you know, that stuff always just kind of just didn't cycle with me. And I was always kind of an apologist when it came to science, that people would say, you know, evolution isn't real. And I'd say, well, you know, I think it is. You know, imagine this, you're an infinite being and you need to make change and you need to remain hidden. Well, the best way is to put in some sort of, you know, some sort of programming in the system that causes them to change their environment over time. And so, you know, I see the hand of God in evolution, and I would make these sorts of arguments. Or, you know, when people within my church would say homophobic things,
mm-hmm.
and I would kind of make my apologist statement about it and say, you know, well, God is love, and I think that God wants everyone to be in love. But, you know, one of the biggest problems in the world right now is human overpopulation. So maybe what God is doing is making people gay or lesbian so that they can still be in love, but not breed, but not, you know, add to this to this problematic thing. And I think I actually convinced a few people that, you know, this must be part of God's plan kind of thing. But I was always working like this apologist angle counter to the,
yeah,
the evangelical doctrine that was being thrown out there. And eventually decided that I didn't want to have to do that anymore. And that, you know, I needed to be honest with myself that I was still praying every day and you know, going through the motions. Because when I commit to something, I commit pretty hard. But eventually I came to my own conclusion about it, said, you know, I want to believe this stuff, but I don't believe it. And if I continue to do this, I'm lying to myself. I'm lying to my friends and family. And if there's a God, I'm lying to him too, which may be a bigger offense. What I should probably do is just try to live my life as honestly as I can and try to do some good in the world within my capacity, within what I'm able to do. And if, you know, if God sees that I have led a good life and that I did good things and was generous and kind and tried to make the world a better place, then that should be enough. You know, that mm-hmm. you know, it shouldn't be, a person shouldn't be judged on a doctrine or on a baptism or on something like that. That doesn't really make sense for an infinite being that is hopefully much more emotionally intelligent than I am. Leading a good life should be good enough. And if it's not, well, fuck him. That's no God of mine. And that was mm-hmm. kind of how I walked away from the church and started looking into other religions and started reading a lot more religious philosophy writings. And when it came down to it, I realized that there are parts of me that have some very spiritual feelings about nature, about wild places, about the sovereignty of things like mountains and rivers and ecosystems. That what I actually believe is probably a lot closer to some kind of scientific animal, where it's like, does everything have a soul? Well, no, I don't think souls are real. I don't think human souls are real either. But would it be a better world if we acted like it? Yeah, probably. You know, do I believe that you know, strip mining on Mount Pilchuck is going to offend the gods and cause a landslide? No, I don't believe that. But do I think it's a good idea to act like it? Absolutely. Yeah, wild places have their sovereignty. They have an intrinsic value besides what they can give to us financially. And these things should be protected for their own sake. When you stare out at the ocean, feeling a sense of awe, feeling a sense of connection to the rest of the life in it, that doesn't make you a bad scientist. You can't publish on it, but mm-hmm. just because it's not scientific doesn't mean that you have to write that out of your character, delete it from your being. You can look out at the natural world and feel a spiritual sense. You can feel awe. You can feel connection. You can be moved to tears by a beautiful scenario, or shaken to your very core by laying on your back higher than pterodactyl titties, staring out at the open cosmos before you and feeling like you're going to fall off the planet and into space. It is okay to have that kind of spiritual experience. It doesn't make you a bad atheist. It doesn't make you a bad scientist. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I'm at, where, okay. you know, do I believe that all of our spirits are connected? No. I don't believe in spirits. I don't really believe in souls. Can I document with evidence, little bit by little bit, that we are biologically and ecologically and chemically connected? Oh, absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. We've done the math. We've tested, found it to be true. So there's a gray area in there where you can look out at this world and say, I am connected to this. It's not that, you know, every man is an island and you're alone in your intellect and you know, I think, therefore I am. This is the only thing that can possibly be true. I think that's a very cynical way of looking out at the world.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at when it comes to my personal philosophy. I'm an atheist. I'm an agnostic. I'm a skeptic. but I also feel a deep and meaningful connection to my environment and the people and animals and plants and fungi and microbes that live in it.
Sounds perfectly congruent to me.
Yeah.
You know, more and more it seems like humanism is including very, very strong environmental and similar elements, because it has to.
Yep.
Pollution in China affects our air here.
Exactly. Yeah. When we do these short-sighted things, we realize in the long run that we're cutting our own throats. And I think a big thing that we need to look at and think about, especially now and in the next few years, is how much of that are we willing to do? How much are we willing to tolerate for short-term gain?
Yeah.
And there is definitely a spiritual component to that. If we say that we're doing this only for human survival, well, then what happens when we're looking at a section of old growth forest that ecologists decide that we could eliminate without affecting human survival? If all we're thinking about is our survival and the amount of profit that can be made, and we don't assign any intrinsic worth to these things other than what it means to us, then what's to stop us from devastating everything that we don't quote unquote need?
Yeah.
But we also need the wild. We also need places where we're not the apex predator. We need places where we are not necessarily safe or comfortable. That part of balancing out, that part of feeling small, that part of feeling like an animal should be a part of our human condition. That should be something that we are willing to coexist with. It's being alive.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. If people want to find out more about you or what do you want to plug?
Right now I would like to plug my employers. Like a lot of environmental education nonprofits, we are struggling right now. So Pacific Marine Research is the one that I work for throughout this part of the year. We take kids out on a boat for the day and they do plankton tow. They learn what's living in the water in Puget Sound. There are tanks of live animals on board that they'll get to interact with those that can be handled. We have scuba divers in the water that give a live video and audio feed of what's happening 60 feet down, and kids can ask the divers questions and the divers can talk back while they're still underwater. It is an awesome organization. We teach over 4,000 grade school students in this area every year. Our scholarship program is now providing scholarships for the most underserved communities in the area because, you know, everybody should have the chance to learn about their environment.
Yeah.
So you can find Pacific Marine Research and the Marine Science Afloat program that we provide at marinescienceafloat.org. Please check us out. Come see what we do. Watch the promo videos. And, you know, if you're local to us, consider talking to your kids' teachers about maybe doing this field trip with us. If you're not local to us, we are happy to take donations. We're working on starting to provide online content now. Please consider supporting us, and we'll see everyone back out on the water on the other side of quarantine.
All right. Very nice. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview, and since it went kind of long, I'm just going to leave it right here. So if you want to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate or patreon.com/atheistnomads. And if you want to contact us, use the feedback form at atheistnomads.com/contact. Hit the SpeakPipe button or send us an email, contact@atheistnomads.com. We're also doing a call out for audio submissions for our next live stream. In 2 minutes or less, tell us your story of how you became an atheist. Yes, 2 minutes or less. Record it on your phone, record it on your computer, use SpeakPipe, whatever way works best for you, and then just email that to us. If you use SpeakPipe, it takes care of all of that for you. And yeah, tell us your story, and then we'll be able to play some of those on the episode 360 live stream. So that's it for this week. Until next time, remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. The music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.